Well, it's great to be back with you again, and I hope that you will try to stay and be with us on this fourth Sunday night, and we'll have our family fellowship dinner afterwards and having a finger foods and trivia night this evening. Open up back to 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel, we're going to be looking at the story of Eli and Samuel, and I think that this will be a very interesting and informative story as we think about the parenting of both of these individuals. When we consider these parents, we're going to think about the woes and the problems that these gentlemen had. And just like last month when we talked about David and the parenting woes that David had, David experienced many with Absalom, Adonijah, and some of his problems, and we tried to give him the benefit of the doubt and to empathize with him and learn lessons from him, because we're certainly not, none of us, perfect parents. I want to do the same with Eli and Samuel as we look at them this evening. Let's begin by thinking about Eli. We're going to look more at Eli than we are Samuel because his story is a little longer. And Eli is known in chapter 2, verse 12, as having wicked sons. In the book of Samuel, it begins by telling about the birth of Samuel, and Eli is the high priest, and Eli is going to be a very righteous and significant high priest for the children of Israel. And in chapter 2, after the birth of Samuel, and Samuel has come to live with him, we read in verse 12 that the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. This involves the idea that they were wicked men. They were worthless. Now, I think we need to be careful in understanding this word worthless. It's not that there wasn't any value to them, that they didn't have a soul or that they didn't have significance in being created in God's image. But rather, they were not fulfilling their purpose. They were not living up to the worth that God intended for them to live up to. And so everybody has a value. No one is worthless per se in their value, but we can certainly be worthless in our actions. And these men were living a life where they should have had a great value as priests of God, but they were living in a worthless manner. Brad, will you shut those doors for me, please? And it just gives a little glare and makes it hard for me to see. But notice, as we continue on, that these men were wicked and worthless, and couple things that are used to describe these men in chapter 2, verse 13, is the custom of the priests with the people was that there, when a man would come to offer sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling. And this is kind of a detail that is interesting, with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot, and all that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, "Give me meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw." If the man said to him, "Let them burn the fat first, then take as much as you wish," he would say, "No, you must give it now. And if not, I will take it by force." Thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. I didn't understand all that was going on there, so I looked at a couple commentaries and read a little bit about what's taking place. And apparently in the Old Testament rituals and things, the priest was to have a portion of the sacrifice, but they were limited in that portion, and then they were supposed to return that portion, the larger portion, to the worshiper. But these men were using a three-pronged fork, and they were taking a large amount for themselves. In other words, they were being greedy, and they were taking a large amount for themselves. And then when it comes to this fat, when the people would offer this sacrifice, they were supposed to take this fat and offer that up as a sacrifice to God. But rather than doing that, they were taking it, not allowing the worshiper to have any. They were taking it all and not offering it up to God, but they were using it themselves.
And the point being is, they were greedy. I mean, they were just selfish. They were taking the food for themselves. They were not giving to the worshipers what they should have received, and they weren't giving to God what God should have received. And they were profaning the worship of God. It was holy worship, but they were making it common. They were turning it, for lack of a better term, in West Kentucky, they were turning it into their own personal barbecue. It had turned into, we're going to get our food off of this. We're not interested in the people. We're not interested in God. This is about us and our food. And they were being greedy. And it was a great contempt. In other words, it was kind of like spitting at God. It was treating something holy as common and profane. And so these men not only did that, but in chapter 2, verse 22, Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to Israel, and how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Now in Israel, they did not have, as some foreign pagan idol temples had, prostitute worshipers and temple prostitutes. So these were not temple prostitutes, but rather these were probably women who either were brought in by these men, or they were serving, and that seems to be the indication, they were serving in the temple courtyards. They were doing some kind of aiding and helping in the temple compound. And these men were so wicked that they were sleeping with these women in that temple area. And it shows that their fornicating nature and their sin they were committing. And so he even heard about these deeds, that they were committing such awful fornication in the temple area. Now Eli is going to rebuke them in verses 23 through 25. So he heard about this, and he says to them, "Why do you do such things?" Verse 23. "For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, it is no good report that I hear the people of the Lord spreading abroad." So all the people were talking about this. "If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord for them to be put to death." In other words, God was upset against them, and he was going to punish them with death. But they wouldn't listen to their father, who tried to rebuke them. Now, I want you to notice something about this, because this is key to the rest of our story. Eli rebuked them. He told them they shouldn't be doing it. He said, "I don't know why I'm hearing all these things. You guys are misbehaving." But who was Eli? Eli was their father, and Eli was the high priest. He was the one who was in charge. Yet he allowed, and this, it seems to me, is going to be key, he allowed his sons to maintain their position as priest. And so notice, the Lord was going to give judgment in verses 27 through 36. Now, notice, this is kind of a lengthy reading, but I want to note several things about it. And I want to go to chapter 3 first, because Eli's primary fault, since I introduced this, in chapter 3, verse 13. "And I declare to him that I'm about to punish." This is when he's talking to Samuel later on. "I'm going to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew, because his sons were blaspheming God." His sons were blaspheming God, and he did not restrain them. The term restrain, or some versions rebuke, and we say, well, he rebuked him earlier in chapter 2. Why is this saying he didn't rebuke him? He didn't restrain him. What does this mean? The term means dimness of sight or of light. It's used in the other texts to indicate when someone, their sight gets weak and they can't see very good, or when you dim a lamp and you put something over it, a bushel over it or something, so that it will grow dim. To weaken, to humble, or to reduce to powerlessness. So the idea is, he should have stripped them of their power. He said, "Hey guys, quit doing that." But he didn't do anything to stop them from doing it. And so it's about the fact that he did not step in. And here's the key. He had the power to do so. When we study this story, I often have studied and maybe preached, and we think about Eli, we think, oh, he was just a bad dad. And he might not have been the best dad when his kids were growing up, because apparently he didn't teach them right from wrong well enough. Or, as we will note later, they just chose on their own to go wicked. But really, this story is about adult children, it seems to me. And it's about a situation where Eli, back to chapter 2, is going to be in trouble because he's the high priest. In our situation, in the church, it might be like if one of the men is an elder and a part of the eldership, and his son is doing these wicked things, and he allows him, and the eldership, because of that relationship, allows him to continue to do all these wicked things. Or in a business context, or a man is the president of the company, he's the owner of the company, but his son is swindling money. His son is doing dishonest things. He's cheating on the taxes, and he has the power to stop that son from doing those things because he's the owner of the business. And he doesn't do anything to stop him. In fact, in chapter 2, back to chapter 2, the reason God gets upset about this in chapter 2 is because of several reasons. Number one, he treated the commands of God lightly. Look at verse 27. This is God talking to Eli. Thus the Lord has said, did I indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt, subject to the house of Pharaoh? Did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to go up to my altar to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me? I gave to the house of your father all my offerings by the fire from the people of Israel. Why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded? You see, he's treating God's commands lightly. It's not a big deal that my sons are profaning your sacrifices. That the sacrifices are being contemptible before God. He takes God's commands lightly. But number two, our second idea here, he honored his sons above the Lord. Look at verse 29b. And you honor your sons above me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel. The third thing is he shared in his son's wickedness. Whether he actually participated or not, God seems to indicate that Eli was getting fat off of those offerings. He fattened himself up. Now, what was the sin? They were taking more meat. They were taking more fat. They were taking these offerings that were not theirs, and they were keeping them for themselves. Well, God is simply saying to Eli, you didn't get upset when your sons were not worshiping properly. In fact, you were eating the barbecue with them. It's kind of what he's saying. You're participating in it. You see, he's upset at Eli, not because he raised his sons right and he did well when they grew up and then they went off, but he's upset with Eli now, because his sons are choosing wickedness on their own. And it's not that Eli, it seems to me, is being held in judgment because his sons are doing wickedness. It's that Eli is being held in judgment because his sons are doing wickedness, and he's not doing anything to stop them, and he has the power to stop them. Now, not every parent's going to have that power. But Eli, in his position, had that power, and he did nothing about it. He shared in their wickedness. He ate the food with them, we might say. Thus, the family's priesthood would end. Verse 30 through 36. I'm not going to read this whole section, but God says in this section that he's going to cut off the priesthood of Eli. Verse 34, I am going to read. Thus that shall come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall be the sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. And I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart, in my mind. And I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before me, my anointed forever. And everyone who is left in your house shall come to implore him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread and shall say, please put me in one of the priest's places, but that I may eat a morsel of bread.
So Eli is rebuked because he had the power to stop them and he did not. Now, I want to fast forward a little bit and tell you the end of the story, and then we're going to go to Samuel.
Chapter 4. So he tells them they're going to die on the same day. Chapter 4, they go out to battle. And they thought that if we go into the battle against the Philistines, we've been kind of getting beat up. We think if we can win this battle, if we take the ark. It seems like Eli did not want them to take the Ark of the Covenant, but his two sons wanted to take the Ark of the Covenant out to the battle. They believed if they had the ark there, they would win the battle. And there's another lesson there, thinking that if you have your Bible, if you have something holy, and you think that that's going to do it, even if God's not really on your side, it's not going to work out. And they took the ark out there, but God wasn't with them because of their wickedness. And the ark is captured by the Philistines. And this is when the ark is going to go into the Philistines' possession, and that's going to take a while before they're going to get it back. But anyways, Hophni and Phinehas are put to death. Eli is 90-something years old. He's old. He's setting down. And at the end of this story, end of this chapter, they are waiting. And when they tell Eli, 98 years old, verse 15, they tell him that the ark has been taken. In verse 19, as soon as he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell over backwards from his seat by the side of the gate. His neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy and had judged Israel 40 years. His daughter-in-law, one of the wicked son's wife, is going to give birth to a son that same day. She goes into labor because of this, the ark being taken and her husband getting killed and all the things going on. And she names the child, verse 21, Ichabod. And that name means the glory has departed from Israel because the ark of God had been captured because of her father-in-law and her husband. And she said, the glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured. And in many ways, this male-born child who is born that day represents the glory having departed from the family of Eli because of the wickedness of his sons. Now let's talk about Samuel. The story of Samuel is a little shorter and not as much information about his sons, but I think it goes well with a study of Eli. Let's go to chapter 8, verses 1 through 6. So Eli, or Samuel, takes over in Eli's place. In verse 1, chapter 8, when Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. Now we find out that he put his sons judges in far off places. And Samuel is going to be a priest and a judge, and he traveled kind of on a circuit, the Bible says. He traveled around on a circuit throughout Israel judging. As he got older, he couldn't travel as much, so he gave his sons some of the farther away regions to be the judge and to try to try them out, to help him out. And their names, verse number 2, Joel was his firstborn, name of his second was Abijah, and they were judges in Beersheba. Verse number 3, yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. And all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. It seems that Samuel's sons leave his ways. They grew up knowing his ways. They grew up in his past. And you get the sense from the text that they chose, because of temptation, they turn after gain. They were greedy and perverted justice. It seems to be the case that they were faced with temptation of money.
It's almost like they get in a position where they are tempted with bribes. They're tempted with this filthy gain and money. And they pervert justice in order to get that money. And so they leave the ways of Samuel. And thus the people desire a king. And this leads to Saul and him becoming a king. But the people want a king. Therefore, and there's an exchange that's going to go on of where Samuel doesn't want a king, but God tells Samuel, no, go ahead and give them a king. It's not that they've rejected you, but they've rejected me. And give them a king. And Samuel does give them a king. And thus it seems that Samuel understands and replaces them as judges with the king. And that he removes in many ways his sons from being judges. Now, the difference then it seems is that his sons had been walking in his ways. And then they turned and begun, because of temptation, to go after filthy gain. And it seems the difference in Eli and Samuel, though I cannot be for sure, it seems that while Eli only rebuked and did nothing when he had the power to do it, and he really condoned his son's actions, that Samuel is going to remove them. We read nothing else about them. They're no longer in a position, it seems, and they are replaced with the king and with Samuel himself for some time. Now, some observations, and then we will leave the lesson for all of us to try to apply. Three observations. Number one, righteous, godly parents can raise wicked kids. Maybe no other issue besides the issue of salvation can produce more guilt, more anxiety or stress than the issue of parents who weep, who have a great amount of anxiety and stress over their children, who for whatever reason, whether we want to use the term wicked, maybe they are doing a lot of sinful things. Maybe they're just unfaithful to the Lord. Maybe they've never become a Christian. And they are not living in your ways. They're not living the way you train them to live. And let me say a couple of things about that. Though none of us want that to happen, and those of us who are raising children need to do all we can to try to prevent that from happening, we need to understand that that has happened since the dawn of time. When you think about it, God, as a parent, had his first children, Adam and Eve, leave and depart from him when they were tempted by Satan. Adam had his sons murder one another as Cain killed Abel. And then Noah, the Bible speaks of one of his sons, Ham, having some problems and having some wickedness. And then you go forward to David, and the list could go on and on about other righteous, godly parents who had unfaithful or wicked children. And now our story tonight, Samuel and Eli, both men who are commended for their righteousness. Eli did a lot of good things, and though Eli is going to really be kind of condemned toward the end of his life, and so we don't want to say too much about Eli, but Samuel is a man who unreservedly throughout Scripture is viewed as one of the most holy and righteous men of Israel. The Jewish people put up Samuel with Moses and Abraham. He was in that upper echelon. And if you think about it, as the Bible describes the work of Samuel, as a judge, as a priest, and as a prophet, he is a man of great righteousness. And even in our story tonight, he seems to be doing the right thing in that when his sons were doing wicked, he is going to make some changes when he had the power to make those changes. And I think that there's something to be to understand there by this then, that the proverb says, train up a child the way he should go, when he is old, he will not depart from it. We understand that's a proverb, and that's generally true. But we also understand that it is the case that righteous, godly parents often who have children that when they are of their age, choose to live a sinful life. And that causes great anxiety and stress and worry to a parent. Number two, failing at parenting harms your future family legacy. Now, one thing from this story that you cannot overlook is that when the next generation fails, and maybe this is not so much a point for parents as it is a point for young people, because the children, Eli's children and Samuel's children, should have thought more about this. Because the next generation, Eli's and Samuel, both failed. And therefore, Eli's family went out of the priesthood, and they are described as going to be hungry and desiring bread and wanting just to be a priest again so they can have bread. And they're cut off forever. And Samuel's family is going, his priesthood and his lineage is going to end with himself. And his sons are not going to be able to carry on his legacy either. And you think about that. In the church, what if there was not a younger generation? What if the church ceased to exist? If the younger generation, those who are coming up, do not pick up the mantle and continue on with the work and service of faith. And so as we think about, you know, one of the things I try to tell couples in premarital, one of the things I think a lot about even as a parent, is that you're raising the parents of your grandkids. You are shaping your family tree. And as when you think about marriage, when you think about what you hope to attain from your marriage and the kind of marriage you want to have to pass along for the example for those future generations, you are shaping your future family tree. And a lot of people come from family trees where the tree has a lot of divorce and maybe suicide and alcoholism and drug addiction, and they have all these problems. Maybe there's a lot of out-of-wedlock births and things like that. What I try to tell people is, you can change your family tree. But I want you to know, young people too, you can change your family tree. And Samuel's sons and Eli's sons certainly changed their family tree. And number three, and maybe this is the most important lesson, God expects us to side with Him over our kids. I want to go back to Eli again and try to reiterate this point that I've been trying to make, is that I don't believe, because I hope to give you some comfort here. If you have a child who's 30, 40, 50 years of age, whatever age they are, and you train them to the best of your ability, yes, you look back and you wish you might have done a few things different, but you feel like you did the best you could to teach them about Jesus. But when they became of age, they have departed the faith, and they are still to this day not faithful. I want you to understand that it seems from our story that Eli is not judged and found in contempt of God because of his children being wicked and choosing to be wicked after he had raised them. But rather, he is judged because he was the high priest. He had the power to stop them from being profaning in their worship to God, and yet he joined them in it and did not stop them. And so God says, you're choosing your sons over me. And so let me just make the point that if you do find yourself, and those of us who have children in our home, and those of you who have children out of your home, if you ever feel like you're in a tug of war, am I going to choose my children and what they prefer, or am I going to choose what my conscience says is right before God? You've got to choose God. You've got to choose God. And you may offend, you may harm a relationship, you may even sometimes cause a little friction there, but what got Eli in trouble is that he chose his kids and he chose their looking over and looking blindly at their deeds over God. Now, it would have been different, I believe, if he would have removed them from the office and said, all right, guys, if you're going to act like that, you cannot be a priest. And he would have sent them out.
and said, you're no longer a priest. And they could have continued to live wicked. And Eli would not have been in trouble then. But he was in trouble because he had the power to stop it. He didn't. Now, lots of times in our culture, we don't have the power to stop it. But we do have the power many times to exert support if we're financially doing things. Or we can enable. And we have to be careful. And we have to prayerfully make those decisions. And we have to maintain our faith over our children. Those are some observations from this story about Eli and Samuel. If you're here this evening and you're not a child of God, certainly would want to encourage you to put Christ on in baptism tonight. If you are a parent or you just are a Christian and you need the prayers of the church, and we would love to pray with you about anything. And it may not be a sin. It may just need, you need prayers of strength. Or maybe you have a wayward child that you just want us to pray for him or her. Or you want to rededicate your life and confess sin. If we can help you in any way, come as together we stand and sing.